So welcome to the seminar. It's great to see you all here and on Zoom, and I'm really looking forward to James' talk. One of the fascinating things about animals is they have sensory systems that we couldn't even imagine. Say a bat who uses echolocation. What does it feel like to be a bat and see the world, hear the world using echoes, or dolphins, or take electric fish who feel the surroundings using electric fields. And among those strange sensory systems that we cannot imagine is seeing polarized light, distinguishing between different angles of light polarization. Now, James has studied in Bristol and did his PhD there, and he looked at light polarization in bumblebees, showing that bumblebees can even learn a particular angle of polarization. He then moved and did a postdoc in Lund, and there he studied dung beetles and looked at how dung beetles can orient at night using moonlight and again polarization. He then did a postdoc in Würzburg, shifting to honeybees, and now joined the cluster and is here in Konstanz and will be using honeybee flight, their waggle dance. And as you know, they use their waggle dance to communicate where is the sun. And that is something they often also do using polarized light. And this is, I think, part of what you will tell us.
Yes,
so, James.
Indeed.
Thank you for being here. Thank you for joining the cluster, and thank you for sharing polarized light insight with us once you get your thing going.
Well, thank you very much, Giovanni, and thank you for all of you turning up, both in person and those of you online. So I will be talking today about my current ongoing project on the honeybee's polarization compass. As you heard, I'm quite new here, so there'll be a lot of background and future plans in this talk, as well as some preliminary data that I've been able to collect over the past year. Interesting. Okay, I'll do it like that. So as you might have guessed from my title, this is going to be a talk about animal navigation. How do animals perform this kind of behavior where they have to move through an environment and ideally find efficient routes through from one place to another? Of course, they can use proprioceptive cues. Those very quickly build up noise and uncertainty. It could also use landmarks like these trees, for example. Those are also subject to both change and parallax as the animal moves around. So the ideal kind of cue would be something at a great distance, like, for example, the sun here. The sun, of course, has a very huge effect on the lives of most animal species, so that their circadian clocks are synchronized to it, and as a large number of animal species have what we would call a sun compass that's even time compensated for the position of the sun at different times of day. So this works really nicely until disaster strikes, and then we need some kind of backup component for this sun or celestial compass. And the component that's used by many species is polarized light. So light is a transverse electromagnetic wave, which means as it moves through space, its electric field oscillates at right angles to its direction of travel. What you see here is a beam of unpolarized light, and it's composed of multiple different waves, all oscillating in different directions. But under certain optical conditions, we can also produce beams of polarized light that are composed mainly of waves oscillating in the same direction. Here you would have vertically polarized light or horizontally polarized light. In fact, while we humans are mostly oblivious to this, you probably haven't noticed polarized light recently, unless maybe you've paid way too much to go and see a movie. but we're by far in the minority among animals with eyes. There's a vast number of species from various different taxa that are sensitive to polarized light. What I've highlighted here are just a few examples of groups that are actually using polarized light to orient themselves. In fact, among the hexapoda, so among the insects, this seems to be a general feature. It's found in everything from Drosophila to the noble honeybee. And the reason that they can do this is because of the pattern of polarized light across the sky. What you see here in this measurement, the orientation of each red line indicates the angle of polarization at a specific point in the sky. The length of the red line shows the degree of polarization, which you can think of as a measure of signal strength. What makes this useful as a compass is that at each point, the angle of polarization is roughly perpendicular to the direction towards the sun. There are some drawbacks to this. One that needs to be addressed straight away is if we consider a patch of polarized light directly at the zenith, because this is an axis, not an angle as such, we actually have two possible solutions for where the sun could be, both of which are perpendicular to the angle of polarization of the zenith. So there's some ambiguity here. And because honeybees are charmingly honest, they'll actually indicate this ambiguity with their behavior, dancing in two different directions within the same dance to produce this bimodal distribution, two different estimates of sun position. But they're not completely at the mercy of the ambiguity of polarization. If we move our patch of polarized light down, so we're looking up at the sky here, bee can do this just by standing still because its eye points upwards, we would have to crane our necks like this. We've now moved our patch of polarized light down away from the zenith, so it's at a lower elevation. We have horizontally polarized light, which indicates a single sun position. And honeybees and indeed desert ants, although strangely only these two species, have been demonstrated to be able to disambiguate this stimulus, identifying a single sun position. They can even update their heading if we rotate our angle of polarization to indicate a different sun position. And through a long, actually the best thing strategy here would be to use two patches of polarized light, preferably chosen from this high degree of polarization band directly opposite the sun, where the signal strength is greatest. If we do this, we can use these two, the angle of polarization in these two patches to very accurately identify the sun's position. So through a long series of very rigorous studies, Lossell and Vaino were able to derive this, the so-called fixed angle hypothesis for the honeybee's polarization sky map. So excluding this one situation we have where the polarized light is at the zenith and ambiguous, if we look at polarized light at any other point, then by looking at the angle and assuming that they're seeing a patch of polarized light that comes from the half of the sky opposite the sun, bees are able to identify a single sun position and update their heading relative to when we rotate that angle of polarization so it should appear in a different point in the pattern. And this is called the fixed angle hypothesis because although angle of polarization is expected to change at different azimuths relative to the sun, so at different points along the horizon, the honeybees apparently don't expect it to change at different elevations. What I find particularly interesting about this model is that around the same time, Brines and Gould actually came up with this, the so-called Rayleigh hypothesis for the honeybee's sky map. And here we have a pattern. It's called the Rayleigh hypothesis because it's a really good match to the predictions of Rayleigh scattering. And here we have an expected pattern of angles of polarization that varies in both azimuth and elevation, and even across different times of day. Gould was actually kind enough to plot out the predictions of the two different models, which are shown by these lines, relative to the observed data available so far, shown by these little points. And you see that neither hypothesis is a really good predictor of what the honeybees actually do. So I really think it's about high time that we revisited the honeybees' polarization compass. I think now is a particularly good time because of some recent advances in neuroanatomical modeling, in methods that we can use to measure polarized light in nature, and also methods that we can use to recreate those patterns of polarized light in the lab under controlled conditions. So in terms of theoretical advances, I'm thinking of this neuroanatomical model developed by my collaborators in Barbara Webb's lab in Edinburgh. And this is aimed at creating an anatomically plausible model for the polarization compass in the desert ant cataglyphus. One of the features that makes this system work is to account for the ocular anatomy. So that's in the dorsal rim area of an insect eye, which is the part that looks directly up at the sky and is sensitive to polarization. And one of the features that that really tunes this whole system is the so-called fan-shaped organization of the different photoreceptors at different points in the eye, looking at different points in the visual field. So you see here we have each of these crosses indicates a pair of photoreceptor classes that are found in a single facet. These pairs are sensitive to different angles of polarization that are 90 degrees apart. And in each one, you'll see their orientation changes slightly at different points in the visual field. If we look at just one of these, we can see what this means for an animal actually looking at a natural sky pattern. So we're going to call one of these classes of photoreceptors the parallel one. That's the one I'm showing on the right here. And we'll call the other one the perpendicular one. And if we show the animal's eye this sky with the sun in this position, then the parallel photoreceptor is activated more than the perpendicular photoreceptor. If the animal spins around its body axis, we get a different polarization pattern or different part of the polarization pattern falling on the same part of the visual field, and it's the other way around. Now the perpendicular photoreceptor is getting more activated than the parallel photoreceptor. We then assume that each of these pairs of photoreceptors is connected to a hypothetical polarization opponent neuron. So this is a neuron that responds more when the parallel photoreceptor is activated and is inhibited when the perpendicular photoreceptor is activated. So for each of these polarization opponent neurons, we should get a kind of sinusoidal response curve like this. And the idea here is that if groups of these polarization opponent neurons are connected up to so-called solar neurons that indicate different sun positions relative to the animal's body axis, a very simple operation, something like a sum of sinusoids, for example, would be sufficient for most simulated natural skies to be able to identify the sun's position very accurately. One of the features of this system and of the simulated natural skies that might help with this is the gradient of degree of polarization that I've mentioned previously, that at the point where the signal strength is highest in the sky, we also have the most accurate estimates of the sun's position using those angles of polarization. And in this model, because of the photoreceptors have a sensitivity curve, which essentially results in a different weighting of information from different parts of the sky. So we get a stronger weighting for information coming from the parts of the sky with the strongest signal strength, which is indeed where we would get the most reliable estimates. So those are the theoretical advances that have been made using theoretical animals and simulated skies. But we can actually now go out and measure those skies. Sony relatively recently released these polarization camera sensors. So these work very much like the sensors in a traditional digital camera, except that instead of having different subpixels for the different color channels, we have different subpixels for different angles of polarization. This presumably has some applications in industry, perhaps for quality control on plastics or pharmaceuticals. But for us biologists, this is a real game changer in that it allows us to measure polarization under natural conditions that were previously incredibly challenging. So this is an example moonlit sky that I recorded last summer. What we can do with this system is record a high dynamic range bracket, then demosaic and combine each image so that we get a separate high dynamic range image for each different angle of polarization. We're able to recover an awful lot of information this way across a huge range of different intensities like we would see in nature. And from these images, we can then calculate the degree of polarization pattern across the sky, the angle of polarization pattern across the sky, and we can even do some post-processing to say what would happen, for example, if we weight the saturation of the color according to the degree of polarization, give the color the angle of polarization, and the intensity to the intensity, to get a sort of idea of what information might be available to animals under natural conditions. We can then take the parameters of these natural skies and reproduce them under controlled lab conditions. Now, LCD screens are not exactly new. You probably have one sitting on the desk in your office, unless maybe you've replaced it with a newer QLED model, in which case I would very much like your old LCD screen, because there's a neat trick you can do to modify this to create a polarization monitor. Once you perform this modification, you can dynamically control the angle of polarization of each pixel on the screen, which can be used then to reproduce the kind of polarization patterns that we would see in nature. Not necessarily a technological advance, but certainly an experimental advance, we now have very good methods for controlling the signal strength of polarized stimuli as well. So this is a filter stack even based method where we move this polarizing filter to different places within this stack of diffusers to produce polarized stimuli with different degrees of polarization. So using these two methods, we can reproduce the parameters of natural polarized light. And that's exactly what I'm doing in this project. The paradigm is to create artificial sky stimuli that are then presented to behaving animals under controlled conditions, so we can then from that behavior derive parameters like, for example, the sensitivity curves that and tuning for the polarization neurons, which we can then put back into our model. And we can then validate the predictions of that model under measured natural skies. I'm focusing specifically on very challenging sky conditions. So cases where signal strength is very low because of haze or fog or light cloud cover, cases where the sky pattern is ambiguous because of mirror symmetry as occurs at dawn and dusk when we have very low sun elevations, and cases where we have both because of very high sun elevations that we can observe in the tropics. So for each of these, we can develop a controlled artificial sky stimulus and observe behavior to derive the model parameters, update the model, and test those predictions in behaving animals with a controlled view of a natural sky that we can then measure so that we can feed that input into the model and see how the model behaves as compared to the actual animals. Today I'll be focusing mainly on the signal strength component because that's the component that I'm currently working on. So as I mentioned before, in a clear blue sky, we can take just 2 points within this high degree of polarization band and use the angle of polarization there to identify the sun's position. But as I learned today, even in constants, you don't always have clear blue skies. It's sometimes cloudy or hazy, and that results in a massive reduction in the degree of polarization across the sky, including in this high degree of polarization band. So, however, still very useful for animals to be able to detect this because the angle of polarization pattern across the sky is quite well preserved. And an animal that can detect this can still reliably identify the sun's position. In fact, based on the predictions of our model, we would expect that the gradient in degree of polarization across the sky that's found in both conditions might actually help the animals if their sensitivity curves lead to different weightings for the lower and higher degree of polarization parts of the sky, so that they end up relying more on the most useful part of the angle of polarization pattern. And there is some anecdotal evidence that honeybees are doing this. In Carl von Frisch's book, he presented some experiments where honeybees were shown a small patch of natural skylight that was then measured so they knew the degree of polarization. Dancers were disoriented, apparently, when shown low degree of polarization skylight, becoming increasingly oriented when presented with patches of skylight with increasing degrees of polarization. I also have some more quantitative evidence for this, not from honeybees, but from nocturnal dung beetles. These are dung beetles of the ball rolling variety, so rather than competing with all the other dung beetle species that are engaged in a competition of who can bury the most dung fastest, these ones sculpt a ball of dung and roll it away from that high competition region, away from the dung pile, in as straight a line as possible to make sure that they can do this efficiently and avoid having their food stolen. And to do this, to roll in a straight line, they use celestial polarization, not of a blue sunlit sky, but of a moonlit sky, which they have to be very sensitive to detect. And not just in absolute terms, but also in relative terms. Because while during full moon, the polarization pattern of a moonlit sky is very similar to that of a sunlit sky, as the fraction of the moon illuminated decreases, so too does the maximum degree of polarization observed in the sky. So how sensitive these beetles are will determine what kind of conditions they're able to actually perform this behavior under and when they'll become disoriented. So to test where this threshold lies, I developed an artificial sky stimulus that was presented to beetles rolling to the edge of a small circular arena. This is a filter stack based system, so the position of the polarizer could be changed between trials to change the degree of polarization presented to the beetle. One quirk of working with this species is that because the aim of this behavior is just to get away from their point of origin, to escape the dung pile, each individual moves in a straight line, but they seem to choose their heading arbitrarily and then stick to that heading throughout the entire behavior. So here you see the tracks of individual dung beetles placed at a dung pile, and you'll see that each one has chosen a slightly different heading, but without any particular pattern. So to account for this, we actually allow each beetle to roll to the edge of the arena twice and take the angle between those two rolls as a measure of orientation error. If we got distributions of orientation error that looked like this. So starting for very high signal strength, we get clustering around 0 and 180 degrees, and then the clustering decreases as we decrease the signal strength. We can analyze this by calculating the mean vector for each individual, taking the average, and then comparing that with a simulated uniform distribution, which is what we would get if the animals were disoriented. And if we analyze the data in this way, we can see that the orientation accuracy is decreasing for with each decrease in signal strength until somewhere between 11% and 4% polarization, the orientation error becomes indistinguishable from disorientation, as we have in the bottom right hand here. So it seems that we do have this kind of sensitivity or weighting effect where with decreasing signal strength, we get decreasing orientation accuracy. I'm now repeating these experiments with honeybees. I'm focusing on the waggle dance behavior. It's a behavior performed by returning foragers to indicate the direction towards a food source that they've just visited to their nest mates. So they move around in a figure of eight pattern like this, and during the straight part, they shake their abdomen from side to side to indicate this is the correct direction to go in. So this is a communication behavior that works like this. It communicates the direction towards a food source to dance followers, which will follow the dancer with their antennae, and then go and fly in that direction. I'm performing these experiments on a horizontally oriented observation hive to eliminate the gravity vector that they would otherwise use as their frame of reference. This forces them to rely on visual cues. What they're viewing is a slightly updated artificial sky stimulus. This is constructed from two rings of UV LEDs that project sideways into a scored plate of polystyrol. What this does is it scatters light down towards the animal where it passes through a polarizing filter producing polarized light. This then mixes with light from a duplicate system that is below the polarizing filter. So you get a mixture of polarized and unpolarized light to produce a stimulus with an intermediate degree of polarization. Using this method, we can produce stimuli across and even beyond the range of natural degree of polarization and indeed intensity to really replicate the whole range of natural conditions. The stimulus is presented to marked foragers that have been trained to visit a feeder at 300 meters away from their nest. This is far enough that it reliably stimulates them to perform dances when they return home. So we're looking at this part of the observation hive. This is the part near to the entrance that's known colloquially as the dance floor. So most of the dances are happening in this region. You'll see we actually have one of our labeled bees here. This is bee number 54. She wants to indicate this direction to her nest mates. She's going to do this by turning around and moving in a straight line while shaking her abdomen side to side. And then she'll repeat that behavior by turning around again and going in the same direction again, shaking her abdomen side to side. So within a single waggle dance, we'll get multiple of these straight segments known as waggle runs, which give us an indication of what direction the animal wants to tell to her nest mates. It looks something like this, if you can see enough contrast. So she's shaking her abdomen side to side and going straight. And she does this several times to produce several different waggle runs. If we plot out the body axis during each of these waggle runs, we get a distribution that looks like this. So she's seeing a stimulus with a single angle of polarization, so we get a bimodal distribution with two clusters separated by roughly 180 degrees. If we then turn our stimulus and see that the distribution of waggle runs changes for the same individual within the same dance. So she's updated her heading to represent the new direction relative to the stimulus. But we're not actually interested in the direction as such. We're really interested here in the clustering, so the orientation accuracy. And based on the literature and our experiments with dung beetles, we expect a response curve that looks something like this. So as degree of polarization increases, we get an increase in orientation accuracy. Now we expect the turning point of this curve, the polarization threshold, to be somewhere around 10%. That's what's been reported previously in the literature. I do have some preliminary data. And we can see here that when we present animals with unpolarized light, we get a uniform distribution of headings. The dances go in all different directions. Whereas when we present quite strongly polarized light, we get very strong clustering in this bimodal distribution that we see here. For intermediate degrees of polarization, we can see this transition from gradually weaker clustering until they transition from oriented to disoriented behavior. Although interestingly, so far, we're actually seeing this transition occurring a little below what the reported polarization threshold is. This might imply that for bees viewing natural skies, there's actually a lot more information available than was previously thought. And perhaps this has been overlooked because of this weighting function that polarized light with very weak degree of polarization can be detected but is ignored in favor of other cues. So their aim with deriving this response curve is to plug that back into the tuning of the polarization sensitive neurons in our models to get predictions of behavior under various different measured natural skies that we can then go back and validate and improve the model. The ultimate aim for this is actually to produce a virtual reality system in which we can take measured natural skies and present them to dancing bees or indeed other insects to observe the effects of different conditions on orientation and how they're interpreted. One particularly interesting application in terms of collective decision making might be to manipulate the accuracy of the dancers to look at how uncertainty in the dancer propagates to her followers. So we could make the dancer more or less accurate by manipulating the stimulus that they're observing. We can also, of course, introduce ambiguity and look at how groups of dance followers deal with the ambiguity in an individual dance. In fact, there's some evidence from the literature that we could even introduce four-way ambiguity using certain polarized stimuli. So there's lots of opportunities for looking at how groups of dancers deal with unreliable or incomplete information produced by the dancing bee. So that's the ultimate aim of this work. With that, I would like to thank everyone who supported my move to Konstanz, in particular Giovanni for hosting me, all those of you who made me feel very welcome since I've arrived here, and all my collaborators and funders, and of course all of you for turning up and watching. And I hope I've introduced sufficient ambiguity that there are a few easy questions for me.
So much, James. That was absolutely fascinating. We have plenty of time for questions.
Thank you very much. I have a question concerning what you called uncertainty.
Mm-hmm.
So you showed us the polarization on the scale up to the middle,
mm-hmm.
and that seemed to imply that if you go higher, you would expect the uncertainty to disappear. Is that what you would say?
Yes, I would expect to an extent. I think you're an expert on this, right? But there is but for whatever reason, there is a maximum level of concentration that we see in these waggle dances. I don't think that this is especially a drawback. This is just a parameter that needs to be accounted for in the model. There'll be a minimum amount of orientedness that we can observe in these experiments, that always other cues, although we try to rule them out or randomize them as much as possible. And there's a maximum level of orientation that we can observe, at least in waggle dances that are produced when trying to indicate a feeder.
Yeah, but that's what I was wondering. But even if they see the sun and even if they have gravity, they will never be precise, 100% precise in their directional indication, right? They always introduce this scatter,
yeah.
which has been discussed as actual the tuned error hypothesis that has some function for the collective, so I was
exactly,
was
that it might even be useful.
Yes.
Yeah, I think that that has to be accounted for as a parameter in this model. You'll see that in my response curves, I'll show now, we do have an asymptote. But that's the case for pretty much every kind of psychophysical experiment you can imagine. We always have some kind of lapse rates. If we do experiments with humans, the lapse rate can be as little as 1% because we really, really like to get it right. But if we do experiments with, for example, learning in bumblebees, we can get lapse rates that are around 20 or 30%. And we just have to deal with the fact that we're working within this specific range.
Thank you very much.
So thank you. In your last proposed experiment, you wanted to make the dancer more ambiguous.
Yes.
Which you do by playing around with the degree of polarization. But that would make also the follower more ambiguous. Do you have any idea of how to make the dancer more ambiguous while giving the follower not that same ambiguity to separate the two effects?
There are certainly ways to do this. I can't think of any experiments where this has actually been done, but I'd be very surprised if this isn't hiding away in the back of von Frisch's book somewhere. You can certainly create a difference between what the dancer sees and what the follower sees. A very simple way to do that would be, for example, to place patches of polarizing filter on the eyes of the dancer, because they're both relying on the same stimulus, they both have the same frame of reference. You could certainly create it so that what the follower sees, for example, is less accurate than what the dancer sees, or vice versa. That's a very interesting idea.
It's from Mark. Mark, you can try asking. Maybe the sound works. It should work.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure. Great.
Okay. Thanks for a very nice presentation. I have heard that solar panels can also change the polarized light environment. So I was wondering what could be the consequences for honeybees if solar panels continue to increase.
Yeah. It's actually quite a common effect. It's more of a problem for aquatic insects, which are not looking for polarized light in the sky. They're looking for polarized light on the ground because it's an indicator of shiny surfaces of water. I've even seen a patent somewhere for basically a mosquito trap that is a solar panel with a fly swatter on it. So you can even see this on the shiny bonnets of cars and things. Lots of aquatic insects try to lay their eggs on various different shiny surfaces. So having shiny surfaces all around the world is not necessarily a good thing for insects. But it's actually very easy to overcome. We don't really want our solar panels to be reflecting light at all. We want them to be capturing light. And I have seen a few studies looking at adding anti-reflective surfaces that depolarize the reflections that come off solar panels and don't attract insects. So that, yeah, it is a problem and there are solutions.
Thanks.
Any more questions? Christoph and then
Catherine. First, a technical question. When you place the hive horizontally to study the dances, the polarization pattern is uniform. It's our same direction all over the place. Is that correct?
That's the aim. So we actually have is. What we actually have is a polarized stimulus that we can move around on a frame. It's on two sets of rollers that allow us to move it around. And we have the camera aimed at the dancing bee so that we can check that it's at the center of the stimulus. But as you saw from my camera measurements, we actually have quite a bit of wiggle room with this kind of stimulus. Because of the way that it's constructed, we don't have strong off-axis effects, and it's relatively uniform if the animal is slightly off-center. But we're still trying to keep it centered so that we have a very tight control over what the animal's seeing during the experiments.
And this is, I'm not quite sure whether I understand this. The aim of this, because you're not reconstructing the natural sky, you're using a polarized pattern to modulate the intensity. Is that correct?
So what we're doing is we're modulating the degree of polarization, so the signal strength. We can also control intensity, and I haven't covered that because I haven't looked at that in detail yet, but also interested across what range of intensity this behavior works. So what we're doing is reproducing specific parameters that we find in natural skies with the aim of building up a complete idea of how this whole parameter space affects orientation. And I'm starting with the signal strength problem because it's the most straightforward to approach.
My second question is, when you showed this computational model of Barbara Webb, you had these ommatidia and the preferred orientation. It's a very limited number of ommatidia. If this is all, that was ant, right?
Or was it? No, that was the ant, yeah.
It was there. It's a limited number of ommatidia available.
Yeah.
And then you showed these false color-coded pictures that you probably can easily read, and or others, it's kind of difficult. Are there pictures showing what the ant is seeing in these kind of pattern? I mean, to map those color pictures on the ommatidia pattern you have in an ant.
Yeah, so that's absolutely my goal with this project, is to get a good idea of what the typical anatomy of the dorsal eye of an insect is, and then to use that for the post-processing step for these images. We've done this quite a bit for the dung beetles, mainly with intensity images, where we have a good idea of what the visual resolution is. But absolutely, that would be the goal, except that I don't think that Cataglyphus is a very good example for this. They have a very small field of view for their dorsal rim area compared to other species. I'm working with some collaborators now who are getting micro CT data on the eyes of various different bee species that have a much broader visual field for their dorsal rim area. And I think that's much more representative of what we see across various different insect species. Locusts or even Drosophila have a very broad field of view for their dorsal eye. And it would be really interesting to then compare that back to the ants, and especially considering what the kind of natural skies are that the ants are viewing as compared to the bees, and see maybe there's a reason why the ants are so weird. In this one particular way.
So when you say the field of view for polarized light is larger in bees, so is there a disadvantage in the ants having the arrangement along the body axis? So do they have to turn around to get a better idea about the polarization pattern, and others not? When I saw this, I thought, well, they have to run around. You know, they have to circle in order to get a good idea.
Yeah, and they do. But I mean, they're certainly not alone among insects in doing that. And there's no doubt that if you have this kind of, I don't like to call it a matched filter, but if you have this kind of filter arrangement, then spinning around is a really good way to very quickly increase the accuracy of your estimate. And we see this in the ants spinning around on the spot. The dung beetles climb on top of their ball and spin around before they start rolling. And the bees, when they take off, perform these circling flights, which allow them to, of course, map the surrounding landmarks. But it can't hurt that they're also turning their body axis and scanning. So that's probably another thing that helps.
Thank you.
Okay,
Yeah, thanks for the great talk. And maybe my question relates to that a little bit. So I was wondering, because you showed that all the different kind of insects and crustaceans and so on, they all have the polarized light vision. So is there an advantage if the animal can fly? Or is there like flying versus walking? Is there pros and cons? Is it better to use it? I mean, as you said, it's good if you can move around quickly, and so maybe flying, you can actually use this information better?
That is a very interesting question. I'd never really considered that.
Or if you have like a honeybee that learned the waggle dance, if you let it walk somewhere or fly somewhere, would it be more accurate in one or the other way? I don't know.
That's a very interesting question. I don't actually know the answer. I know there have been experiments. Actually, there's a paper on BioArchive at the moment in walking bumblebees where they show that walking bumblebees can use polarized cues to path integrate. So there we would have a nice option where we have animals that will forage by walking or flying, where we could actually compare the two and look at the accuracy. But it's certainly, as I say, this seems to have developed very early on in insects, and almost every insect species that people have looked at, they've found a dorsal rim area. And if they have an accessible behavior, they've also found orientation to polarized light. But as you say, a lot of insects also fly, and maybe there's some advantage there, but I don't have an intuition about that.
I would like to thank you very much, James. This was very, very great talk, wonderful, and also very interesting, also new topic here. Thank you all for coming, and please also keep in mind that we have free coffee in the cluster kitchen upstairs, so if you would like to grab one and hang out a little bit with everyone, then please feel invited, and thanks a lot for coming today.
Thank you.